The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article was published by the Religion News Service on September 6th, entitled, Elon Musk's Threat to Sue an Anti-Semitism Watchdog Extends Platform's War of Words, by Yonat Shimron. Since buying Twitter last year, Elon Musk has developed a seeming obsession with the Anti-Defamation League. Over the last several days, the owner of X, formerly Twitter, has posted at least 25 times about the ADL, a nonprofit Jewish group that fights anti-Semitism. His fixation grew on September 4 when Musk threatened to sue the group, initially for $4 billion and subsequently up to $22 billion, claiming the organization's criticism of his management of X has led to a 60% drop in advertising revenue. In one post, he said the ADL was trying to kill the platform. It all began in November when the ADL called on advertisers to pause their spending on the social media site until it becomes clear whether Twitter remains committed to being a safe place for advertisers as well as society overall. The ADL itself resumed advertising on the site a few months later. A spokesman confirmed to Religion News Service that the ADL again halted any spending on advertising on X as of this weekend. Musk may also be aggrieved by an ADL report issued in May that found an increase in anti-Semitic content on the platform and a decrease in the moderation of anti-Semitic posts. That report cited the platform's decision to reinstate influential users it had once banned because of posts deemed anti-Semitic, which resulted in some 5,000 conspiracy-laden anti-Semitic posts. Those posts included disinformation about George Soros and the Rothschild banking family, often repeating long-standing conspiracy theories about Jews controlling global politics, finance, and media, as well as statements about Jews pushing a radical agenda to destroy the West. After X's new CEO, Linda Yaccarino, met with ADL's chief executive, Jonathan Greenblatt, last month, in an effort to improve relations, some X users launched a campaign with the hashtag #BanTheADL. Jake Shields, whose bio on X identifies him as a mixed martial arts champion and right-wing extremist, led the charge. Let's get this trending to help wake the masses of how evil they truly are, Shields posted. The hashtag soon became a top trending topic, and on September 1, Musk liked a post supporting the campaign. At one point, he suggested X run a poll on whether to ban ADL from the platform. At the same time, Musk denied any personal anti-Semitism. In a September 4 post, he said, "To be super clear, I'm pro-free speech, but against anti-Semitism of any kind." The ADL's Greenblatt responded in a statement, "It is profoundly disturbing that Elon Musk spent the weekend engaging with a highly toxic anti-Semitic campaign on his platform, a campaign started by an unrepentant bigot that then was heavily promoted by individuals such as white supremacist Nick Fuentes, Christian nationalist Andrew Torba, conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, and others." Greenblatt called Musk's threat of a lawsuit frivolous and said Musk's behavior was reckless and dangerous, coming 2 weeks ahead of the Jewish high holidays. The Forward, a daily Jewish publication, has since recently started a running list of Musk's disturbing contents. Now an article published on August 30 by the Religion News Service. BYU officially restores honor code ban on same-sex romantic behavior, by Catherine Post. LGBTQ students at Brigham Young University celebrated 3 years ago when the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints flagship school quietly deleted from the honor code a ban on homosexual behavior. For the first time, many students began holding hands or kissing in public. Others took the moment to come out as queer. Then, a month later, the church educational system administrators who oversee BYU's campuses issued a statement clarifying that, despite the deleted language, same-sex romantic behavior wasn't compatible with the honor code. The church educational system restored the language to the code, explicitly prohibiting LGBTQ affection, now called same-sex romantic behavior. Though the ban had never really lost its effect, for some of the students, the official restoration of it still felt like a gut punch. It's heartbreaking to see it repeated over and over again that queer students aren't welcome, said Gracie Purcell, a BYU psychology major. Every time they reinstate and repeat it, it hurts a little more. The Honor Code, a set of guidelines that employees and students are expected to follow, is enforced by the administration on the main campus in Provo, Utah, as well as BYU Idaho, BYU Hawaii, and Unseen College. It instructs all community members to live a chaste and virtuous life, including abstaining from sexual relations outside marriage between a man and a woman. The new language adds that living a chaste and virtuous life also includes abstaining from same-sex romantic behavior. In a fact list included with the announcement, the church educational system noted that the ban on same-sex behavior does not represent a change in LGBTQ policies. Disciplinary responses to students holding hands, kissing, or going on dates with members of the same sex will be handled on a case-by-case basis to help each student feel the love of the Savior and to encourage them to live their gospel covenants and university college commitments. The announcement declared that LGBTQ students are a welcomed and valued part of the campus community and share a common identity with every student as sons and daughters of God. A BYU spokesperson referred media requests about the honor code to the LDS Church, which declined to comment beyond the press release. After the church educational system's announcement, three groups for queer BYU students or alumni, the Rainbow Collective, the Out Foundation, and Understanding Sexuality, Gender, and Allyship, released a joint statement on social media acknowledging that while they oppose any prohibition of same-sex romantic behavior, the updated language is in some ways a step toward transparency. I'm just glad people can now finally see explicitly what's happening, said Evelyn Telford, one of the vice presidents of USGA, a community group for queer BYU students that is not affiliated with the university. There's no way to get around it that they are openly being discriminatory to queer students. However, the group said that the updated guidelines create a discrepancy between how same-sex romantic behavior is treated in the LDS Church and how it is treated at church-affiliated schools. In 2019, Russell M. Nelson, president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, reversed a 2015 policy that categorized same-sex LDS couples as apostates and that barred their children from religious rituals, including baptism, unless they received permission from top church leaders. The 2019 reversal of that policy allowed lay bishops to authorize the baptism of children of LGBTQ parents. In a 2019 devotional given at BYU, Nelson also clarified that while the church still opposed gay marriage, homosexual immorality would be treated in the eyes of the church in the same manner as heterosexual immorality. Purcell argued that the new honor code language means queer couples can be disciplined even if they are following the same chastity guidelines assigned to straight couples. This, she said, is out of step with the church's overall policy. Depending on where you are, who your religious leaders are, you can actually date people of the same sex with very little church repercussions, said Purcell, 20, who is also president of the Rainbow Collective. At BYU, that usually gray line within the church is a hard line. Anything that they deem homosexual behavior or same-sex romantic behavior is not allowed. Though the honor code strictures may not change how LGBTQ students are disciplined at BYU in practice, Telford is concerned the change could increase isolation. It's going to make us all a bit more nervous to be out and doing things with our friends, said Telford, 22, who said she's worried that simply hanging out with people of the same sex could lead to punishment. Most of us are just trying to go to school here. Most of us are just trying to make it by. And now that there's such vague language, it feels like people are looking at you all the time to see if you're going to slip up and do something wrong. Telford said she's often asked why queer students come to BYU in the first place. She said, academic opportunities, location, affordability, and family ties at BYU are all factors students might consider, adding that there are other students who, like her, didn't realize they were queer until getting to college. It's such a personal decision to be at BYU, and your sexuality shouldn't mean you don't deserve a place here, she said. As the school year at BYU begins, Telford said she and other queer students in USGA plan to keep meeting regularly, resisting the isolation of being on a campus where expressing themselves isn't officially welcome. Purcell and others in the Rainbow Collective also said that they would continue hosting their annual off-campus back-to-school pride event on September 16. She added that she hopes the administration will consider how these updates impact the emotional and mental well-being of queer students. The lack of representation and the increase in religious and societal pressures won't stop queer students from coming, said Purcell, but it will hurt them. Now, an article published on August 29, entitled New Jersey Town Accused of Discriminating Against Orthodox Jews Will Pay $575,000 Settlement, by Catherine Post. A New Jersey township accused of discriminatory zoning policies and surveillance against Orthodox Jews has reached a $575,000 settlement with the state, the New Jersey Attorney General announced on August 28. The order prohibits Jackson Township officials from discriminatory zoning and from discriminating against religious assemblies. The Orthodox Jewish community in Jackson Township wanted to build religious schools and places of worship. The town will be required to pay $275,000 in penalties, plus $150,000 toward a restitution fund for those harmed by the town, and another $150,000 if they violate the consent order. No one in New Jersey should face discrimination for their religious beliefs, Attorney General Matt Platkin said. The settlement announced today is a powerful testament to our commitment to protecting residents' rights to religious freedom. The Orthodox Union, an organization that supports Orthodox synagogues, welcomed the settlement. In a statement to Religion News Service, Nathan Diamant, Executive Director of Public Policy, noted that over two decades ago, the Orthodox Union joined a coalition of faith organizations advocating against local government's discriminatory use of zoning and land use laws, an effort that resulted in the federal Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. We are grateful that the New Jersey Attorney General and the Division of Civil Rights, with the support of the U.S. Department of Justice, took action against the Jackson Township government for engaging in this kind of discrimination against Orthodox Jews, who sought nothing more than to reside as good citizens in Jackson, said Diamond. We appreciate that the settlement provides both compensation to those who were wronged and puts measures in place to ensure such hateful actions are not repeated. In April 2021, New Jersey's Division on Civil Rights filed a complaint against Jackson Township, its zoning board, township planning board, and mayor, alleging that they had violated the New Jersey law against discrimination. According to the 2021 complaint, a group of Jackson residents began complaining about the influx of Orthodox Jewish residents as early as 2015. Residents wrote to township officials raising alarm about an extremist religious group seeking to take over our town and destroy our neighborhoods. Residents amplified these grievances through social media with hateful rhetoric, saying that the gang war has begun and we need to get rid of them like Hitler did, according to the complaint. In 2016, the complaint says, the town adopted a surveillance plan to monitor homes where Orthodox Jewish residents were allegedly gathering for Shabbat. The plan resulted in regular, often daily home monitoring of suspected congregations. The complaint alleges the town devoted significant resources toward surveillance of these lawful prayer meetings for several years. The complaint also alleges that the town reinterpreted existing laws to inhibit the erection of sukkahs, temporary open-air structures used during the Festival of Sukkot, or Feast of Tabernacles. In 2017, the township unanimously passed an ordinance that the complaint says prohibited religious schools in almost all of the town's zoning districts. The ordinance also prohibited dormitories, which some Orthodox Jews believe are necessary for yeshiva students. Jackson officials were aware of the ordinance's discriminatory impact, which effectively bans both religious day schools and yeshivas in Jackson, the complaint says. The complaint attests that the town also prohibited eruvim, ritual enclosures usually created by attaching wire or string between poles that symbolically extend private spaces into public spaces. Some Orthodox Jews use eruvim to designate places where they are permitted to take part in activities, such as carrying items from a private to public place, that would otherwise be prohibited on Yom Kippur or the Sabbath. The complaint alleges that in 2017, the town began a campaign to ban eruvim by enforcing a township code that prohibits items that encumber or obstruct public areas and streets. In September of that year, the town council passed an ordinance that the complaint said was effectively prohibiting eruvim. In agreeing to the settlement, the town does not concede liability for the claims included in the 2021 complaint. However, the settlement does require the town to publish a description of its permitting requirements for sukkahs and to repeal and replace zoning ordinances that allegedly block Orthodox Jews from opening religious schools and from establishing eruvim. The town must also establish a multicultural committee to draft recommendations to the town's council and create a public education campaign aimed at ending discrimination and bias within the town. The town is required to notify the Division on Civil Rights of any policies or decisions that could impact the free exercise of religion or religious land use and must submit to ongoing monitoring of its compliance with New Jersey's law against discrimination. The mayor and other officials implicated in the order must participate in annual trainings on discrimination in land use and zoning. This isn't the first time a New Jersey town has faced a lawsuit for discriminating against its Orthodox Jewish residents. In January, an Orthodox Jewish school in Jackson Township received a $1.35 million settlement from the town after Jackson's zoning officials prevented the congregation of Oros Beis Yaakov from building an all-girls school for nearly a decade. 3 years earlier, Woodcliff Lake, a town 90 miles north of Jackson Township, settled a lawsuit with an Orthodox Jewish group that said the town repeatedly blocked it from expanding its building. Religious freedom is a bedrock principle of American democracy, and we are deeply committed to protecting it here in New Jersey, said Sandeep Iyer, director of the Division on Civil Rights. As hate and bias, including against the Jewish community, continues to rise, it is critical that we call out religious discrimination when we see it. And it is especially important that we hold public officials accountable when they treat people differently based on their faith. Our last article is an excerpt from one published on August 30, entitled Young Hindu Professionals Get a Crash Course in Keeping the Faith, by Risha Karmakar. Temples are built for young people, said Umar Mysarikar, the president of Hindu Temple Society of North America, otherwise known as HTSNA, to an audience of young Hindus gathered at a large temple spanning a full block in New York's Queens Borough. The mix of college kids and other young professionals had come to participate in Akshayam, a venture sponsored by HTSNA to keep the lessons of the faith in front of the next generation of Hindu leaders in the U.S. Through community service and educational consortiums, Akshayam's organizers are also aiming to regain a hold on a religion being pulled in multiple directions by India's nationalist politics on one hand and Western influence on the other. Sitting in the temple's Parvati Hall, named after Hinduism's archetypal mother goddess, these Hindus are here to discuss the Ramayanam, an epic narrative that tells the story of God's incarnations and their interactions with humans. To be Hindu is to read, said Vishwa Adaluri, a professor of philosophy at Hunter College in New York, and one of the day's panelists. Noting that children of other faiths have long had Sunday school class, Bible studies, and other avenues to have rich theological discussions from a young age, he said it is now time for young Hindus to incorporate the study of their faith into their identity. The young people in the room appeared more than willing. As religious scholars presented the importance of the steadfast relationships between Ram, Lakshman, and Sita, the Lord, his brother, and his wife, and Ram's epic journey to retrieve Sita from the half-man, half-demon Ravana, the young people were full of questions about passages that have long been seen as problematic. Why, for instance, did Lord Rama banish his pregnant wife, Sita, away to the forest, setting up her kidnapping by Ravana and her need for rescue? The answer is often related to the ancient texts, to the moral questions of the modern world. According to Adluri, villagers in Ram's kingdom began speaking poorly of Sita behind her back by questioning her chastity. He banished her to maintain his own and his kingdom's dignity. Adluri pointed out how this impulse manifests today in social media, he says, where gossip and slander about others grows wings, sometimes leading us to believe misinformation. This, said Adluri, is how ordinary people become asuras, or demons. While the Ramayana and Hinduism's other main sacred text, Mahabharata, had been exploited for many TV and movie dramas, most recently the controversial movie Adipurush, scholar Aditi Banjari said reading the text yields so much more nuance to those willing to spend time with it. As English translations and online resources proliferate, Banerjee says it is more important than ever for Hindus to fully embrace their sacred text, rather than fall prey to shiny Bollywood films and TV shows that can obscure the Hindu narrative. The least we can do is to read the the Ramadana and the Mahabharata, to be practicing Hindus and good humans in society. That is our duty to our ancestors, she explained. Adita Shastri, an engineering master's student, said he was lucky to have been raised attending religious classes at his temple in the well-populated Hindu community of Dallas. After moving to New York to attend Columbia University, Shastri came across several young adult-oriented Indian community organizations, but fewer religious ones, until he found Akshanams just this year. When we were learning about the Ramayana and Mahabharata as kids, there were so many complex ideas about gray ethical things that we didn't have a framework of understanding, said Shastri. Now I have the ability to go back and study these issues in a more mature way. Shriya Anand, a student at Columbia University's Teachers College from the Bay Area, joined Aksham to find a community in New York. I wanted to find like-minded younger folks who are interested in learning about what it takes and what it makes that is important to be rooted in this culture, said Anand, who performed a bhajan, or devotional song, at the start of the program. Both Shastri and Anand said they are often the only ones among their friends to be involved in religious discussions of this kind. Ravi Vaidyanath, the temple's religious consultant and a prominent scholar from a priestly lineage who helped to found Aksham, said the Anubhava conference is meant for young Hindus to discuss the faith's beliefs among themselves. In doing so, rather than, for example, watching a movie depicting the epics, they are far more likely to retain what they learn, he said. Our Vedana, Hindu philosophical tradition, is derived out of questioning, not just listening, he said. Customs and traditions keep changing, he said. The texts we have are not about religion or about prayer. They are about science and the way of life. Even atheists are considered in our faith. We underestimate how beautiful our traditions and our texts are, said Banerjee. We shouldn't be insular or exclusive. We're not evangelists. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.